They call it the path murder, and it's the kind of crime that stays with you for a long time after you learn about it.
Police allege 40-year-old Rohini Bisazar stabbed a shopper in a financial district drugstore unprovoked Friday afternoon.
Rohini Bisazar now stands accused of second-degree murder after Junior was stabbed in the chest in what police are calling a random, unprovoked attack. Bisazar smiles while appearing in court this morning.
Attempt murder charges were upgraded to second-degree and then first-degree murder after Rosemary died from her injuries. The judge today ordering Bisazar to undergo a thorough psychiatric evaluation at CAMH.
The eventual diagnosis was schizophrenia, and the eventual charge was first-degree murder. And 3 years later, a horrifying story is finally inching towards an ending. So who is Rohini Bisazar, the accused? And who is the victim, Rosemary Junior? Why did this happen and why did it captivate a city? Is Bisazar fit to stand trial? A jury this week said yes, other assessments have clearly disagreed. And how does our justice system deal with cases like this, where mental illness so clearly plays a role, but the act itself seems premeditated and purposeful? We're about to find out. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
I think the tragedy here is that it's so hard to recognize this kind of mental illness. Nobody around her, the people who loved her the most, could really understand what was going on with her until it was too late.
Raizal Robin is a freelance writer who's written for The Walrus and Toronto Life and other publications. She went as deep into this story as it's possible to go in her cover story for Toronto Life. So, Raizal, tell me what happened on December 11th, 2015.
Well, that's the day that Rosemary Junior, I think, walked into her work, and she thought it was going to be a normal day at work, and just did what she always did. She operated an ultrasound machine there at MedCan, and which is a private healthcare clinic, and had just a kind of a nice normal day. And then she went out for some reason around 2:30, went to go to grab something from a Shoppers, and ended up getting stabbed to death. In this case, the person accused of the stabbing, Rohini Bisazar, is probably mentally ill. She has been undergoing aggressive psychiatric treatment, from what I've read recently, and has been deemed finally fit to stand trial. And once the trial is underway, we will definitely know how it happened.
What about Rosemary? Did you look into her life? What was her life like?
She came from a hardworking immigrant family. Very religious family. They're Catholic and just seem to be very supportive, hardworking, good people. And she's the only child who ended up in university. And they were all like sort of gunning for her. She was the star of their family. She was the baby and the star and very, very loved by her family.
Did they know each other at all, Rohini and Rosemary?
There's no indication they did.
What happened in the moments immediately after Rosemary was stabbed?
Well, she was on the phone just before the stabbing. Rosemary was talking to a friend of hers, congratulating her for something. And at that moment, she was stabbed. I've been told in the newspapers, it says it was a vital organ that was hit. And I was also told it was her heart. Obviously devastating, the stabbing. And she was immediately crippled by it, but was able to speak. And she apparently went to a pharmacist and told them she's been stabbed. And someone needs to help me. I think security was called and ambulances were called. And as soon as they got there, she was whisked away to St. Michael's Hospital.
Was Rohini arrested then?
No, she got away. She was, I think, just wandering around Toronto. I'm not sure where she was staying.
How did she get out of the Shoppers Drug Mart right after that happened?
She just walked out. She walked out as soon as it happened. Rohini was apparently caught on camera leaving the Shoppers, and that's all we really know about her being there.
And when was she arrested then?
Several days later. So there was a manhunt for her. During the manhunt, she sent an email to the National Post, because there was all sorts of media going on at the time, stories circulating about her.
What did the email say?
It said, "Something has been happening to me and this is not my normal self. And I would like to know who and why this is happening. There is either a single person or more responsible, and who and why would be nice to know. I am sorry about the incidents. I felt the need to be extreme to see if it would work. I would normally not do such a thing."
She was on every news station.
She was. I think the city was really captivated by her story, and even the country for a while.
And you, at that time dug into the life of Rohini Bisesar, the alleged killer.
I think that's all we could really do, like journalists could really do at the time, is look at the background of these women and find out what, just get as many facts as we could to the public at the time.
Yeah. Who is Rohini?
She is a woman who came from a hardworking immigrant family. She's one of four siblings. She seems to have come from a very hardworking, successful family. Her neighbors, from when she was a child, said that the family was wonderful and academically focused and great, great kids. The only trouble she had, apparently, is mental illness. And this is something that's now been substantiated. She's been through psychiatric treatment. It's definitely out there. And I think the tragedy here is that it's so hard to recognize this kind of mental illness. Nobody around her, the people who loved her the most, could really understand what was going on with her until it was too late.
When you looked back on kind of her life in the years leading up to the incident, tell me a little bit about what her life was like. What was she doing?
She was working really hard to get ahead on Bay Street. She had done her MBA and then was working at York to try and just make ends meet. And then just worked her butt off trying to find a position in a Bay Street firm. Ended up finally getting into Jennings Capital, which I think later became Mackey Capital. I can't remember. And then after that, she got into GMP, which was a big big deal to get into. That's a good company to get into. So she worked for a couple of analysts and just had a hard time with the job, the pressures of the job. It's an intense environment to work in,
right. Highly
competitive, very male-dominated. She felt, apparently, according to her colleagues, that she was, you know, being sort of the butt of jokes, or didn't really get that frat boy humor that you kind of have to get into, and that even if you're a woman, you have to be able to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently she just had trouble with all of that. That's just coming, you know, from her colleagues at the time, so not from Rohini herself.
Were there any signs that she was mentally ill or that her illness was getting the upper hand? Like, did this manifest itself in that incident?
From what I could gather, the signs seemed to be that from her boyfriend at the time that she was living with when she was at GMP, they shared an apartment for a couple of years, and he said like she was just getting increasingly paranoid, is how he described it, saying that she was worried that people were spying on her at work and were getting her to sign documents that she wasn't given proper time to read and understand, when it could have been the illness that was keeping her from comprehending those documents, and certainly the paranoia, I think. She wanted to go shopping for spy cameras on keychains, and it just started to get a little bit odd in his eyes. The way he described it to me was like the movie A Beautiful Mind, when you just kind of start seeing things just don't make sense all of a sudden. You can see someone's really intelligent and they're articulate and they're speaking about, you know, whatever the worries and concerns they have at work, but then it just starts going off the rails and it starts sounding a little bit odd. That's all that he could really, he didn't understand what was going on with her, but he could see that she wasn't acting the way she used to act. After they broke up, and she lost her job, I think the real sign was when the police were called to her parents' house because she had damaged a door and there had been some outburst. The details of that are a little bit fuzzy.
And she split up with her boyfriend a little bit before that. Where did she go after that?
Nobody really knows. She went to live with her aunt for a while. She was in and out of there, from what I understand. It's difficult to paint an accurate picture of where she went before the crime took place, because she was really homeless. She was actually homeless.
People saw her. Where
People
was
saw
she?
Her, yeah. She was hanging around during the day, apparently hanging around at gyms and Starbucks on Bay Street. She was just hanging around and drinking her coffee or I think it was just hot water. She would just order hot water a lot and just sit there, sometimes staring off into space, sometimes sleeping, sometimes working on her computer. She went to some popular pubs and restaurants down in the financial district, like upscale ones, and would sort of just sit there and bring her own granola bar in or something. That's kind of how she passed the time. She never worked out at the gyms that she went to. She would sit there on her computer in the change room, sometimes use the shower, do her makeup. It's really sad.
What happened?
I think she just didn't know what was happening to her. I think nobody really understood what was happening to her.
Did she talk to anybody about it? I don't even mean professionals. Like, what did her boyfriend say? Was she telling him anything about what was going on?
Well, she would share, you know, her sort of paranoid thoughts. And, you know, he just kind of went along with it. Like, he was there in that relationship longer than he wanted to be there at the end, I think. But he felt he really owed her something because in the early days she supported him financially and she also supported him in emotionally in other ways to make something of himself. And at the time, you know, when he met her, he was kind of foundering a bit and didn't really understand what he wanted to do with his life. And he was a musician at the time, wasn't very successful. But he was very good at math and at business. And she just really encouraged him to stick with that and just work really hard. And they kind of, the two of them got into this, you know, lifestyle together where they were working really hard, that Toronto downtown condo. And so he felt he was going to support her through this rough period, which to him was just looking like unemployment.
You went to visit Rohini in jail. What was that like?
Yeah, well, you have to, you know, schedule an interview with an inmate, first of all. As a journalist, you normally have to go through a lot of red tape to get an interview. And usually in provincial jails, which is what Vanier is, people haven't, unless they're serving a really short sentence, like 1 year or maybe two, they haven't yet been convicted of anything. They're just waiting for their trial. So yeah, you get a real mixed bag of people and a lot of people who don't want to talk to the media and probably shouldn't talk to the media because their trial still hasn't happened yet. So what I did was, all I did was call up the main, not even the media relations, forget it, I'm not going to go through them. Yeah. I just called up the main, the front desk, and I said, I wanted to come and talk to an inmate. How do I do that? And they said, okay, well, you need to tell us who it is, and then she'll come see if she wants to. And that's as simple as it was. And so I took the chance. I went, I gave my name, and she came to see me. It was quite something. You know, she didn't have much else to do that day, maybe. Yeah. Who knows? And she also did want, I felt at the time, my perception was that she wanted to get her story out. She did want to tell her story. And you know, because she told me I need to manage my image and that sort of thing. So she felt like she was somehow being misunderstood.
What was that discussion like?
I showed up. She showed up. I went into, you know, a room, a private room with, you know, glass in between us. And she comes in and picks up the phone, and she was wearing green, kind of looks like hospital scrubs or something, like a sweatshirt and green pants. Mm-hmm. And her hair, you know, in all the photos you see on in the media, she's looking really put together and beautiful, perfect makeup,
even
hair.
Even when she's homeless.
Even when she's homeless, yeah. But, she, you know, prison was a little harder on her. She didn't have access to any of those things. And her hair and makeup weren't done. And, you know, she just looked like a sad kind of small person. So she was very pleasant. She was very polite and knew that she shouldn't be talking to a journalist. I identified myself as a journalist and told her I was working on a story for Toronto Life and that I had spoken to some people and I wanted to check some facts with her and see if she could do that. And she said she really can't talk to me. And I said, that's fine. Is there anyone from your past, any friends? You know, people, I was looking for like even allies, like especially allies, people who would remember her from her childhood years and talk about any details about her that bring the person to life for, you know, the public. She just said she couldn't really talk about anything. So I have received a couple of phone calls from her since the article.
She calls you.
She's called me twice. And again, I've told her I can't really share the details of those calls, but she has reached out. And I mean, she hasn't told me anything that's not in the story, to be honest, but it's just interesting. I think she does want her story told. I think she wants to, you know, it's got to be a really odd place to be, I imagine, if you're mentally ill and then you receive treatment for that illness and you have a chance to reflect on something that you've done or been accused of doing. It must be a really odd, disconcerting place to be.
What have the last couple of years been like in terms of the case? The reason we're talking to you now is because a jury declared her fit to stand trial. The trial is supposed to begin this Friday. This has been a long back and forth.
Exactly. She has been declared fit before. And this time, I think, is a little different because she has received aggressive psychiatric treatment. The first time she was declared fit, she was still immediately, as soon as the hearing started, she began talking about devices being implanted in her and that sort of thing. And I think at one point she refused to believe that the victim, Rosemary Junior, was actually deceased. And so at this point, you kind of can get caught in this back eddy, like a legal back eddy. If you're dealing with mental illness, you're suffering from mental illness and you're accused of a crime, you have to be declared fit to stand trial. So you have to go through the treatment. And then, you know, depending on when your case comes up, because it doesn't always come up immediately. So say you go through 6 weeks of, you're ordered for 6 weeks of treatment, and then you're going to go back to Vanier, and then you may or may not be under the same kind of treatment at Vanier. And so you may become ill again. And then by the time your trial comes up, you're ill. And so you can't go, like, so, you know, it's a really difficult situation to be in. And Rohini actually had one of the best lawyers she could possibly have fighting for her case back, I think it was like post Calvin Berry. And then she had another lawyer. He was, his specialty was dealing with mental health, mental illness, clients who were mentally ill. And she fired him, like, she just, because he wouldn't believe that, you know, devices were implanted. And then she wanted to defend herself. It's a really complex thing legally when you're dealing with mental illness and you're accused of a crime. Now the whole thing really hinges still on whether she's not criminally responsible or not.
Which is different from fit to stand trial.
Right. That's fit to stand trial is like you're going to have your trial. And then it's like, well, what's the argument going to be of, you know, for her? Or what's her defense going to be? So her defense is going to have to be not criminally responsible, probably, I imagine. So the, you know, her lawyer would argue that she was not in her right mind at the time, and she can't be held responsible. Look at the case of Vincent Lee.
Yes.
In Manitoba. He was the man who was accused of beheading and cannibalizing a fellow bus passenger. Vincent Lee was deemed not criminally responsible. He was not in his right mind. He said he heard the voice of God telling him to do this. So he was put in a psychiatric facility and then received treatment and was out 5 years later.
Yeah.
And so I think the trouble with these crimes are, you know, first of all, it's extremely rare for people with schizophrenia to become violent.
Yeah.
It's more cases of violence toward themselves than anyone else. But when it happens, I think it really captures the public's attention because it can be so horrific, and there's no resolution. There's no
motive.
Right or wrong. Yeah. There's no good and evil kind of thing, right? There's none of that thing that narrative that we seek, I think, is really there. It's just a tragedy all around, because if we had been able to see these things or catch these things earlier, it could have been totally preventable, right? And to see that in Rohini's case, she definitely had treatment before, and she had been, you know, there were all sorts of signs, but we don't really recognize them when they're happening around us. The only time we see it, recognize it for what it is, it seems to be, is after something terrible has happened.
Razel Robin, writer for Toronto Life, The Walrus, and other publications. That was The Big Story. You want to hear more from us, so head over to thebigstorypodcast.ca, check out some other episodes. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think. Give us a story idea. We need them. We love them. Hit us up on social media at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can download us. You can rate us. You can review us. Only 5 stars, please. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We will talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.